Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, the planet Mars. We have the latest news about the three new arrivals at the Red Planet. Then, some poetry about the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity. And finally, the late Carl Sagan gives an oversight of the evolving understanding of Mars and its impact on our culture. We begin, though, with a primer on Mars, presented by Kids Learning Tube.
Let's visit the planet of Mars. There's so much to learn on the planet of Mars. The red planet in a billion stars. Come and sing along about the planet of Mars. On the fourth planet from our burning sun, and the second smallest planet in our solar system. I have the tallest mountain named Olympus Mons. It's the biggest volcano in our whole system. Phobos and Deimos are my two moons. Phobos is larger of the orbiting two. It circles me three times a day, and that's true. But it takes 30 hours for Deimos to loop. Let's visit the planet of Mars. There's so much to learn on the planet of Mars. The red planet in a billion stars. Come and sing along about the planet of Mars. I'm 142 million miles away from the sun and its heat, and that's why I'm chilly. When you're on my surface and you probably freeze, I am a cold negative 81 degrees. 24 hours and 37 minutes long. It's a full day on Mars, so you've learned in this song. 687 is the amount of days it takes to orbit the sun for my year to take place. Let's visit the planet of Mars. There's so much to learn on the planet of Mars. The red planet in a billion stars. Come and sing along about the planet of Mars. Let's visit the planet of Mars. There's so much to learn on the planet of Mars. The red planet in a billion stars. Come and sing along about the planet of Mars.
Welcome to Mars Months. I say months because we'll be looking at Mars during the rest of February and well into March. As we reported on last week's The Space Show, the Emirati craft Hope is now safely in orbit around Mars. Let's backtrack a little. The first report was filed last year, shortly before the July 19 liftoff.
450 engineers and technicians have been hard at work for 6 years building Hope. Literally. That's the name of this spacecraft, the Hope probe, which will launch towards Mars later this week. It will make history as the Arab world's first interplanetary mission. And while this Dubai-based venture could radically improve the world's understanding of the Red Planet, the project manager has his sights set closer to home.
Reaching Mars is not the main goal here. It's a mean for a much bigger goal. It's about the future of our economy, about creating the post-oil economy, a creative, innovative, and a competitive economy.
Oil is the bedrock of the UAE's economy, accounting for 30% of the nation's GDP. But with demand expected to peak within decades, leaders have made economic diversification a top priority. And they hope initiatives like this will help.
So when it came to building the mission, the government was very clear with the team. They told us, build it, don't buy it. You can work on a knowledge transfer program. So we partnered up with the University of Colorado at Boulder.
15 international partners contributed to the autonomous spacecraft, which will try to capture the most comprehensive picture of Mars's atmosphere ever. Three different instruments will analyze hydrogen and oxygen levels for an entire Martian year. for 687 days. And this data could help researchers infer why the red planet became uninhabitable.
Scientists believe that more than 4 billion years ago, Mars was a life planet. It had similar features and characteristics as Earth. Something went wrong there and it turned into a dead planet. So better understanding what happened to Mars will help us better understand the changes happening on Earth.
If all goes according to plan, HOPE will reach Mars in 2021, coinciding with the 50th anniversary of the country's founding. It'd be an impressive feat for a space agency that's less than a decade old, and where over 90% of the mission's employees are under the age of 35. But team members think this is just the beginning.
This is the golden age of space in the UAE. So this is what we're starting now. So we're having our astronauts, we're having our Mars mission. So this is going, I think it's going to go down, like this decade, it's going to go down in our history books.
For that golden age to continue, encouraging children to pursue scientific studies is key. And initiatives like this could help them do just that.
I feel in the beginning, just before the mission was announced, there was this kind of stigma, if you go into science, like, where is your career going to be at? But I think for our kids and the next generation, even my daughter, myself, like, she can grow up and say, you know, I want to be an astronaut.
Our second report was made 3 weeks ago as HOPE approached Mars.
The UAE's HOPE probe will enter Mars orbit at 7:45 p.m. UAE time. The HOPE probe, which launched into space in July 2020 from Tanegashima in Japan, has travelled for 7 months and covered over 493.5 million kilometres. This will make the UAE the fifth player to reach Mars after the United States, the Soviet Union, China, European Space Agency, and India. Mars orbit insertion is a complex maneuver, where HOPE rapidly decelerates to enter a stable orbit with Mars. The spacecraft is rotated to position for a deceleration, which will last for 27 minutes. Firing all of its Delta V thrusters, the spacecraft will slow down from its cruising speed of 121,000 km an hour to something nearer to 18,000 km an hour to achieve the Mars orbit insertion. This is the most critical part of the mission. The stresses on the spacecraft of all engines firing at once are far beyond those at launch, and it will be completed with a 22-minute two-way radio delay from Earth. Some 10 minutes following this MOI burn, the HOPE probe flies into the dark side of Mars.
And by that it means that it flew into the shadow of Mars before emerging on the other side. Now, Omar Hussein is the lead mission designer and navigation engineer at the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center. His job was to plan HOPE's course to Mars. Just hours before orbit insertion, he described his task.
Now my role is to track where the satellite is at all times, in order to basically know when to do the maneuvers and when to basically slow down in order to get captured by Mars. The Mars orbit insertion, basically we have to slow down the speed of the spacecraft to a speed in which we can get captured by the Martian atmosphere. So we'll be burning about half a ton of fuel for 28-29 minutes just to slow down in order to get captured by Mars. It's a very crucial maneuver for us, of course. It's very important for us to be like pretty accurate with it, because slowing down the spacecraft, if we don't slow it enough, we're not going to get captured by the Martian gravity. And basically, we're going to escape into an orbit that's going to orbit the Sun. And we won't be able to get back into Mars until 2 years later. However, if we burn too much, then we risk crashing into Mars. We found the right balance in order to do the maneuver, and basically have a safe margin both ways. We've been ready for this maneuver. We have all of the contingency plans and everything in place, so we're pretty happy with the way our design is. Hopefully it's going to go fine. Success is really within our grasp for this mission, although the failure rate is 50% for Martian missions, but so far what we've seen, we're on the right path.
Ali Al-Suwaidi is a satellite engineer with the Emirates Space Agency, and he described the pre-launch simulations that were needed to be done, the tests they had to do while the mission was en route to Mars, and he's speaking just a few minutes before the Hope craft began its orbit insertion.
PLOSSAT is an important part of this mission. It has been used prior to launch to simulate and understand the design of the spacecraft and how it could function to meet our objectives. After launch, even, it became more important where we are through our 7 months of transition from Earth to Mars. There have been several activities on board the spacecraft that has been simulated on FLASSAT to understand how the spacecraft is going to work, what functionality or capability of the spacecraft would be reached within this environment, the deep space environment, since we don't understand that completely without even having components out there. As we approach MOI, Mars Orbit Insertion, FLASSAT even became more important where we need to precisely understand how the spacecraft is going to function and be captured by Mars. During this period, FLASSAT has been used to test several activities or several events of the MOI to understand how the spacecraft is going to respond if things went in an unexpected way, where we tried turning off components or understand what failures could happen. Since MOI is very critical, we have a 30-minute window to burn and be captured by Mars orbit. It's very hard to measure confidence or success rate in this matter, but we built something that we're confident in. We ran several tests, hundreds, thousands of tests, whether that's analysis or even simulation on FLASSAT. The spacecraft team has monitored the spacecraft throughout this period, and we believe that we have the confidence into performing a successful Mars orbit insertion.
And Ali's confidence was justified, and the craft entered orbit. A short time after last Wednesday morning's orbit insertion, Sarah El-Amari, the head of the UAE Space Agency, spoke about the event.
I study the impact of...
Becky, I'm over Mars at the moment. It's been quite a remarkable journey of over 6 years now of working on this mission. A series of challenges. I think the most nerve-wracking of them was the last 27 minutes that I don't ever want to redo in my life again. But we did it. We're around Mars for the very first time as the fifth nation and the very first Arab nation. For right now, we have the very first weather satellite of Mars around orbit that will give us a better understanding of climate change on Mars and also the role of climate, the role climate plays in atmospheric loss. This is a first for the world. This is a first for scientists around the world. We're really looking forward throughout the next few months to get to the point where we are able to release the data to the public. But for me, what was most interesting is the spacecraft for the very first time has been designed for this mission. It was used at its toughest point, 27 minutes to get into orbit. It went exactly according to plan through the meticulous effort of countless people, sleepless nights, over 5.5 million working hours for us to get to the point that we are at today. I've started working on this program at the end of 2013, and it's been a series of challenges that we've sometimes thought were unsurmountable from a technical perspective. From also doing this for the very first time, people weren't used to the way that we were designing and developing this mission. We had only 6 years to design and develop it. The budget that we had wasn't very high. We went through a lot of challenges. We went through various times where things broke when they weren't supposed to be broken. We had to fix it in time to get the spacecraft to where it needs to be today. I'm really grateful with the performance of the spacecraft. What has made this mission remarkable, Becky, is not only the 200 Emiratis that were working on this, it's the 450 people from different continents, from different backgrounds, from different beliefs. This was truly an international endeavor, and this is what science needs to be. This is what exploration is all about.
That was Sarah El-Amari. Mariam Youssef is the science data analyst on the mission.
I study the impact of varying atmospheric conditions to the lower atmosphere on derived thermophysical properties on the Martian surface. Thermophysical properties are properties that affect the energy budget. So the ultimate goal is to use diurnal data from EXI and EMIRS to investigate this impact. So up to receiving the scientific data, the science team works on developing the scientific models and algorithms for the scientific data processing and interpretations. And after receiving the science data, the science team will be working on calibrating, verifying, and analyzing this data. The significance of this data is basically we will have diurnal coverage, which hasn't been found before or investigated before by previous missions. So having this day-to-night coverage, seasonal coverage, global coverage, gives us an advantage of knowing what's happening on Mars. History of Mars, we know that it was a wet environment, but nowadays we know that it's a dry environment. So we need to understand what's happening on Mars. Having this data, especially from the UAE, can inspire the youth to go into the science field, since it's a scientific mission. And it's actually one of the programmatic objectives is to enhance the knowledge of the scientific community and the engineering community as well in the UAE, and to build those capabilities in the UAE.
This is Mars Month on The Space Show here on Selen FM. After a 202-day journey from Earth, China's Tianwen-1 spacecraft entered orbit around Mars at 11 p.m. last Wednesday. The maneuver was monitored by the 70-meter diameter steerable radio telescope in Wujing District in northern China. Tianwen will now conduct multiple orbital adjustments before beginning to survey potential landing sites in preparation for landing in May or June. A relatively flat region in the southern part of Utopia Planitia is the likely landing zone. It is thought, based on evidence from American orbiters, to be the edge of an ancient ocean or lake. Scientists will search for evidence of water ice. The Tianwen-1 rover will leave the lander and explore the area for an expected 90 days. Last August, soon after the launch, we received this report from the Chinese state broadcaster CGTN.
Mars has become a graveyard for robots. More than half of the 47 missions so far have ended in failures of various kinds. But we humans just love throwing robots on Mars. There have been one or two missions every couple of years for the past two decades. But this month alone, there have been three separate missions. Tianwen-1 from China, Perseverance from the U.S., and Hope from the UAE. So what's going on out there? Well, the launching window in July offers a great saving on fuel. Like airlines, space agencies want to find the shortest route to Mars, but it's not when the two planets are at their closest, as you might think. Well, the solar system is constantly shifting. Every time Mars completes a single orbit, Earth goes around Sun almost twice. That makes space travel far more complicated than a straight line on Earth. Actually, if you launch when two planets are at their closest distance, a point known as Mars opposition, your robots may never get to Mars. Instead, scientists will patiently wait for a time when Mars has a head start. Then they would not aim the spacecraft towards where the Mars is at a launch time, because by the time you get there, the Mars will have already moved right here. Instead, they need to point it somewhere ahead. And where Mars is going to be when you arrive. This orbit has been called the Hongmen Transfer Orbit, which was first proposed 1925. Everything needs to be calculated carefully because this launch window happens for just a few weeks every 26 months. Now the window's open, and missing it means two more years of waiting. Well, transfer orbit will take Tianwen 7 months to travel hundreds of millions of kilometers. Choosing a shorter way would ironically require more fuel. The bad things about this orbit is that theoretically, the propulsion system just needs to kick in twice during the trip. To get off Earth at the beginning and catch up Mars when it approaches. And you should barely use fuel in between. When it's getting a bit more closer, at about 400 kilometers away from Mars, it needs to slow down in time so that it can be captured by the planet's gravity and become a satellite of it, or it may miss Mars forever. Landing on Mars is no easy feat, even for a small robot like Tianwen-1. Unlike the Moon, where China has landing experience, Mars has twice the surface gravity an atmosphere, and is littered with dense rock, which makes the landing efforts much more risky. After orbiting for a certain time, the lander will separate and prepare to dive. It needs to find a perfect angle to hit. Too shallow, and Tianwen would bounce off and tumble into the deeper space. Too steep, and it would burn up before reaching the surface. 5 minutes of free dive, and Mars' atmosphere will slow Tianwen from 4.8 kilometers per second to 460 meters per second. Then it deploys its parachute to further slow it down to 100 meters per second in less than 2 minutes. Then it will inject the bulky heat shield, but it'll still be too heavy to reach a safe landing speed. So it needs to activate its small rocket engines. They will further slow it down until the lander can hover at about 100 meters above the ground before a nice, gentle touchdown. If everything goes well, about a week later, China's rover will take its first steps on Mars. It all starts when a craft hit the atmosphere. Then the landing process will take 7 to 8 minutes, during which over 1,000 different maneuvers need to be accomplished. But that alone cannot explain why the Americans call it the 7 minutes of terror. Don't forget, even at the closest distance, we and Mars are about over 50 million kilometers apart, or over 6 minutes for a radio signal to travel. That means the lander has to finish all those acrobatic movements on a strange planet millions of kilometers away, all on its own.
A few days ago, this report from the Planetary Society.
Tianwen-1, a mission to Mars by the China National Space Administration. Water doesn't currently exist on Mars' surface, but it used to. We know this from dramatic dry canyons and river channels seen from orbit, as well as minerals on the surface that only form in liquid water. About 4 billion years ago, something happened to Mars' atmosphere, and most of the liquid water evaporated. But some of it may still be underground. Could those ancient pockets of water contain life? China's first Mars mission, Tianwen-1, consists of an orbiter and a rover. The mission will search for these pockets of water using radar mounted on the rover. Other objectives include mapping and characterizing the planet's surface, searching for water ice, and studying the atmosphere. As of 2020, only NASA has successfully landed and operated spacecraft on Mars. More countries exploring Mars and our solar system means more discoveries and opportunities for global collaboration. Space exploration brings out the best in us all. When more nations work together, all of humanity wins.
Tianwen-1 has been taking images of Mars for 2 weeks now, beginning when it was 2.2 million kilometers away. The data from the rover will be relayed to Earth by the Tianwen-1 orbiter. That orbiter has a design life of about 1 Martian year, which is about 2 Earth years. The name Tianwen means questions to heaven and comes from a poem written by Q Yuan. Considered to be one of the greatest poets of ancient China, he lived from about 340 to 278 BCE. To enter orbit, Tianwen-1 used its 3 kilonewton orbital control engine for 15 minutes. Their 5-ton probe consists of, as we've said before, an orbiter, a lander, and a rover. And the Chinese call the rover a patrol. More about the missions to Mars coming up.
Become a sojourner if you have the spirit, and the opportunity like a risen phoenix. Seize your curiosity to gain insight. Fred Califf, JPL data scientist, geologist.
The landing of the Perseverance will happen on Friday at 7:30 a.m. That much is certain. But will it be a success? Or will it be a crash? Well, that remains to be seen. This feature of the entry, descent, and landing from the folks at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
Nothing can be taken for granted when you get to Mars. There's a lot of things we just don't know.
Space always has a way of throwing us curveballs and surprising us.
I mean, until we get the data that says we're on the ground safely, I'm going to be worried that we're not going to make it.
Entry, descent, and landing is often referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because it takes about 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere of Mars to the ground safely.
The spacecraft has to do all of this by itself.
There are many things that have to go right to get Perseverance onto the ground safely.
There's a lot counting on this. This is the first leg of our sample return relay race. There's a lot of work on the line.
Starting about 10 minutes before atmospheric entry, we get rid of really the spacecraft part of the rover that's been supporting us.
We come screaming in to the Martian atmosphere at 12 to 13,000 miles per hour.
And the heat shield is what dissipates all that initial energy through friction.
The vehicle will continue actually flying itself through the atmosphere. It's sort of like a transforming vehicle that went from spacecraft, and now it's kind of like an aircraft actively guiding itself.
When we're going slow enough, we deploy a parachute.
It's the biggest supersonic parachute we've ever sent to another planet. It's critical for slowing down the vehicle.
Perseverance's entry, descent, and landing borrows heavily from that of Curiosity.
But fundamentally, Perseverance is a different rover. She's bigger, she has different instruments.
We've added a lot of smarts on the inside to make it more capable so that it can deal with the landing site that we've given.
The science team identified Jezero Crater as basically an ancient lake bed and one of the most promising places to look for evidence of ancient microbial life and to collect samples for future return to Earth. The problem is it's a much more hazardous place to land.
You look at Jezero, all you see is danger. How do we go to a site that we never thought was safe enough to go to before? So the heat shield, which has protected us all the way through entry, is no longer necessary. We need to get that off so that we can actually see the ground. And we can see the ground in a couple different ways.
Perseverance will be the first mission to use terrain relative navigation. So while it's descending on the parachute, it will actually be taking images of the surface of Mars and determining where to go based on what it sees. This is finally like landing with your eyes open. Having this new technology really allows Perseverance to land in much more challenging terrain than Curiosity or any previous Mars mission could. Amongst the rocks and the craters and the cliffs, these things are hazardous to the rover, but these are the things that are interesting to the scientists.
Once Perseverance has figured out where she is, we jettison the back shell and parachute and light up our rockets. Those rockets help us steer to a safe landing spot that's nearby.
That descent stage takes us all the way down to about 20 meters off the ground.
That's when we start the sky crane maneuver. And once the rover has hit the ground, the descent stage will cut loose from the rover and fly away to a safe distance. Surviving that 7 minutes is really just the beginning for Perseverance. Its job, right, being the first leg of sample return to go look for those signs of past life on Mars. All that can't start until we get Perseverance safely to the ground. And then that's when the real mission begins.
Before being launched towards Mars, engineers had to take Perseverance on a test drive. No, they weren't sitting on it, but they were controlling it remotely. 10 years earlier, these engineers had put Perseverance's older sibling through its paces in the clean room where it had been assembled. Judith Vanell, who presents that wonderful program Stay a While between 11 a.m. and noon every Monday, reads a poem about curiosity's driving test.
First Drive by Stuart Atkinson. We came in our virtual droves to watch her rove for the very first time. Not yet beautiful or elegant, none watching could ever claim that of the white metal box balanced on its six fat coal-black wheels. She sat there, frozen in the floodlight's glare, like a robot flying trapped in sky-blue amber, or a captured and chained alien machine surrounded by wide-eyed scientists, shining snowman white in their oh-so-funny bunny suits, some standing, some kneeling, others lying flat on the sterilized ground like snipers, long-lensed cameras, not rifles, levelled at the creature crouched there before them, all waiting for it to move, all waiting breathlessly for proof its wheels really could carry its bulk across Barsoom. Then one by one they were gone, leaving the clean room silent and still. Just a single blue light stolen from the TARDIS roof, blinking slowly in the corner. I watched through four layers of glass, the first and last separated by several thousand miles, smiling as one by one the engineers and techs returned and, urged on by furiously typing upstream viewers, many playing truant from their jobs in schools and banks and bars, waved at the camera from the floor, self-consciously at first, then, the party mood taking hold, more boldly. One bravely broke into a robot dance, arms and legs jerking stiffly to our delight. Final, definitive proof that rocket scientists are people too. But as we cheered and laughed, behind him the rover, offended by all this mocking of her kind, said nothing and stubbornly refused to move. Suddenly a veritable invasion of bunny men, the clean room packed again as the big moment approached. The rover, surrounded, brooded on its cobalt coral mat as stalking techs walked this way and that around her, taking up position as the time ticked by. Gingerly, two took up the braided tree trunk cable, connecting her to her disembodied brain, and we knew her time was near. She's moving, I called out across the room, as, without warning, the black barrel wheels began to turn, rolling the rover across the floor, snail slow at first, but oh, so beautifully. It's alive, a happy upstreamer typed. Another tapped, woohoo, as MSL slid silently across the blue. One day those wheels will roll o'er Mars, scrunching and crunching over Eris ancient rocks, carrying curiosity, her cameras and computers across the big country landscape of the next new world. And each soul they do, back here on Earth, 1,000 unashamed rover huggers will remember the pride they felt the day they saw her take her baby steps, first drive.
Thank you, Judith. And now we go to Austin, Texas in 1988, where Carl Sagan was speaking to a planetary science conference. He addresses the question why we should go to Mars.
Another role that Carl has had is that of Cassandra. Most of you, I think, remember your mythology well enough to know that Cassandra was given a fate by the gods. The fate was to be able to foretell the future, but the second half of that fate was never to be believed. Now, Carl has been a very effective Cassandra. I hope people will begin to believe him, because some of the things he's been pointing out to the human race more effectively than any other scientist I know is, for example, the great perils the human race is facing, and in particular the nuclear arms race, and even more particularly nuclear winter as one of the possible consequences, or at least a nuclear fall may be the answer. Anyway, the point is this is a very important role, and again, very few scientists play it or play it effectively. I hope all of you have seen the Parade article from last February, which spelled out some of the reasons why the Soviets have cause to be worried about the United States and vice versa, an article published in the Soviet Union as well as here. So we have a Cassandra with us tonight. But now, to wrap up, I am not infrequently asked by people who don't know. They say, gee, everybody knows Carl, but is he a scientist? And the answer is, oh my, yes. Carl, Carl is one of the leading lights in the planetary realm of science in the world today. Just to mention a few high spots of his work, not necessarily the ones he would pick, he was the first scientist who pointed out that Venus must be hot with really cogent reasons for it before missions really got there to land on it. He was the first scientist to realize the character of dust on Mars and the immensely important role it has to play in what we observe there long before missions really landed there. Done fundamental work in the systematics of planets around other stars, in the chemistry of clouds in the solar system. He heads a very lively scientific research group in these areas and others at Cornell. Carl is very, very much a scientist. After this introduction, you may think that I agree with Carl on everything. Well, almost. Not quite. I believe we need to go to the moon before we go to Mars, but I realize there's another point of view on that. Carl has the floor tonight, and I think he'll do a pretty good job of presenting his case. So it's a great pleasure. Carl, please join us.
Harlan, thank you very much for that extremely generous introduction. I'm most happy to be here in this elegant lecture hall and to have an opportunity to talk to people from the Austin community, including members of the Planetary Society, and also planetary scientists who are attending the annual meeting of the Division for Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society here in Austin. I have to say something about Lyndon Johnson, since this whole building and this lecture hall is named after him. There are lots of things to say about him. But I think I will just mention his remark. He made a number of them about space, but there was one that I find especially important. He said that the military reconnaissance satellites were worth the cost of the entire space program. And I heartily agree with that, because those satellites have the extremely important role of calming the hotheads and paranoids on both sides, who, if given full rein, would manage to do us in. And in fact, the issue of war is a part of what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about Mars, but as you know, Mars is named after the god of war, and I hope to have a chance to explore a number of different connections between Mars and war. I'll try not to be too long, because I'm very much looking forward to the question period, since by and large I've heard this talk before. It's the question period that's likely to have provocative and challenging questions, and therefore some degree of real stimulation for me. Mars in Roman mythology was the god of war. The Romans and the Greeks before them, who called that god Ares, had to personify the idea of war, because it seemed to come unawares on people. It seemed to come from outside them. Afterwards, they would look and say, how could we have been so foolish? But at the time, they were captured by it, caught up in it. The reason that Mars, that particular world, was named after the god of war is speculative, but the prevailing wisdom is that the connection comes from the color. Mars is red, clearly red to the naked eye, as most of you have doubtless noticed in the last few months. And blood is red, and blood is spilled in war, and so maybe that's the connection. The reason Mars is red, incidentally, is because it's rusty, because it has iron oxides on its surface, and it is true that the reason blood is red is because it has iron in chelated in the hemoglobin molecule. So, by a curious coincidence, the chemistry is more or less correct. Tonight, or I forget, maybe tomorrow night, is the 50th anniversary of the famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938, which panicked millions of Americans who had not yet made the distinction between media fiction and real-world fact. That distinction has still to be clearly made in America, in American life. 1938 was the time that Hitler was strutting over Europe. It's the time of Munich. It's the time of the Sudeten crisis. It's the time where the fear of invasion was in the minds of lots of Europeans and, by extension, in the minds of Americans. So the report done in dramatic, although time-compressed style, that Martians had landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and were busy using Star Wars technology to destroy everyone who came near, was taken very seriously. And there were people who raced in their cars to the mountains, abandoning wives and children, and other useful revelations of character. And Orson Welles himself, who was in his early 20s when he produced this thing, was astonished at how many people took seriously what he had imagined as a Halloween fantasy. Now, the Orson Welles radio program was based upon an H.G. Wells novel, also called The War of the Worlds, and that in turn was based, in a way, on real astronomy, semi-real astronomy, namely the work of Percival Lowell, an American scientist who established an observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, who had mapped what he believed were canals on the surface of Mars. He drew maps of single and double straight lines unerringly crossing vast expanses of Martian terrain with uncanny rectilinearity, straightness. And he argued that no natural process could produce such unerringly straight lines, that the straightness of the lines was a clear indication of their artificiality, that they were produced by intelligent life on Mars. And he had a story, as a hypothesis, a model of how that came about. Mars was a dying planet. Its smaller gravity did not permit it to retain an atmosphere of the same density of the Earth, and so it was parched and withered, the water having largely escaped to space. And Martians who had evolved in previous epochs of the history of that planet were engaged in a vast water reclamation project in which the melting polar caps each spring were connected with the canal network, and the water was redirected to the thirsty inhabitants of the equatorial cities. And Lowell went quite far in his deductions. For example, he deduced from the fact that the straight lines go enormous distances, and therefore, if it were the same as the Earth, would cross international boundaries, that Mars did not have international boundaries, that it was a planetary society. He even deduced what its political system was and pinpointed the capital. It was a place where lots of canals emerged. Well, as I've said on another occasion, the argument is almost entirely right. There is no question that the straightness of the canals is compelling evidence for their intelligent origin. The only point at issue is which side of the telescope the intelligence was on. And we now recognize that it was our side, not the Martian side of the telescope. The canals do not exist. They are a snare and a delusion. Some terrible vulnerability, weakness of the human hand-eye-brain system led Lowell, under conditions of imperfect seeing, and not just Lowell, by the way, but a bunch of other astronomers, to probably connect up disconnected fine detail into straight lines and deduce canals where there are none. But that was not definitively established until the Mariner 9 mission to Mars in 1971, although it was certainly the prevailing view of the astronomical community. But Lowell was so effective, a popularizer of his work, and so passionate in his conclusions, and the idea is so entrancing that this nearby planetary neighbor has a global civilization of technological beings who are somehow our older brothers, that the idea took on a life of its own. And in 1897, H.G. Wells wrote one of the classic and also one of the earliest science fiction novels in which the Percival Lowell Martians were given a fictional but very potent manifestation. The idea was that, yes, they're running out of water, and they cast their eyes enviously, was the way that that Wells described it, at nearby worlds. Are there any that have lots of water? Oh my goodness, look at this one. This blue one over here. They have more water than they know what to do with. Let's take them over. And so the account was about how earthbound astronomers found puffs of smoke and flashes of light on Mars, and then strange vehicles were seen in the skies of Earth. They landed, strange tentacled Martians equipped with hydrogen bomb-driven X-ray lasers or the equivalent, then utterly destroyed the primitive armaments of the Brits. For H.G. Wells, they landed in England. For Orson Welles, they landed in New Jersey. And both the novel and the radio broadcast ended with the Earth helpless in the clutches of malevolent and extremely thirsty Martians. Which brings to mind. Now, H.G. Wells's approach was not just for science fiction. He was making a strong political point. And his political point was that Britain, he was British, had to first order, this was late Victorian age, conquered the world. I can recall in 1897 Queen Victoria Jubilee postage stamp from Canada, which has on it a greater empire than has ever been. Mercator projection of the Earth, and red everywhere. In those days, red meant British. And you could see all over the world, significant fraction of the Earth's surface was under the British Imperium. Wells mentions in his novel the great cost of this British conquest, including the extermination of the Tasmanian Aborigines, who were hunted as if they were wild animals and rendered absolutely extinct by British colonists, many of them sent to Tasmania instead of to jail. Wells was trying to give us a sense of the tables turned, of what it would be like if we had the inadequate military technology, if beings far in advance of us were to come here. Just the perspective of Tasmanian Aborigines and Zulus and people all over the world to the British superior military technology. Okay, so it ends sort of badly for humans. It's distressing. It's not upbeat. In fact, the Wells novel was not to the American taste at all. And that is why, 1 year later, a sequel was published without, as far as I know, any permission from H.G. Wells, by an American popularizer of astronomy and well-known writer named Garrett Serviss. And his novel was called Edison's Conquest of Mars. The Edison is Thomas A. Edison. You know, electric light and phonographs, movies. Mars. This book praises Yankee ingenuity, as exemplified by Thomas Edison, and picks up where Wells left off. Thomas Edison discovers that Great Britain has been conquered by Martians, puts aside for a brief period his other technological efforts, and then not only succeeds in utterly defeating the Martians on Earth, but he then arranges for a human invasion of Mars. And we turn the tables back. And everything works out wonderfully for us, but not so well for the Martians. This was, by the way, written on the eve of the Spanish-American War. Now, Thomas Edison was, of course, by this time already a legendary figure. This is why Serviss inducted him, perhaps unwillingly, to play the title role in his novel. And there is a most interesting sequel to this. The connection between Martian astronomy and science fiction and the real world of the Earth are strangely intertwined. Because when World War I rolled around, there was, in many popular circles, in part because of the Serviss book, the expectation that Thomas Edison, having quickly dispatched the Martians, could easily handle the Kaiser. And a general sigh of relief was heard when a letter was published from the Secretary of the Navy, written to Edison and asking him to supervise military research and development in the First World War. And let me quote from that letter. By the way, this aspect of Edison is from a first-rate new book by Bruce Franklin called War Stars, The Superweapon and the American Imagination, just being published by Oxford University Press. Here's the an excerpt from the letter by the Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, in 1915, to Thomas Edison. We are confronted with a new and terrible engine of warfare in the submarine. With your own wonderful brain to aid us, the United States will be able to meet this new danger with new devices that will assure peace to our country. Well, Edison enlisted. There seems to have been absolutely no significant weapons that emerged from Edison's organization. But nevertheless, it had the greatest historical importance because it was the first attempt in the United States to create, under government aegis, a partnership of academic science, industry, and the armed forces in order to fight a war. It played no role in the First World War, but it played an absolutely key role in winning the Second World War, and led, after 1945, to the institutionalization of what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address as the military-industrial complex. And in that short interim, its most celebrated products were radar, proximity fuse, nuclear weapons, and rocket delivery systems. That is, there is a funny causality loop in which the imagined Martians coming to Earth lead to the development of the technology which permits humans to go to Mars. I don't say that it wouldn't have happened without it, but still, that's something sort of cute. I think these inventions would have been developed had Wells and Service and Edison never lived, but maybe not so quickly. The timing, nature, and governmental acceptance of this partnership would have been different. So Mars, in perhaps just a small but nevertheless interesting sense, has played a role in the origin of the nuclear arms race, which, if left in unhindered, promises to defeat the human species more comprehensively than the Martian cabal ever could. It would be fitting if Mars, therefore, could help end the nuclear arms race, if the planet named after the god of war could play some role in helping to bring peace to the Earth. And I want to talk about that possibility a little later. And this, by the way, is not the only connection between Mars and war. And I'll mention a few others.
And that mention will happen in next week's The Space Show. That was the late Carl Sagan speaking in Austin, Texas in 1988. And that's part of our Mars Month here on The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. We'll be back next week.